Good morning and welcome once again to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk. We're streaming live, so if you want to stay with us, you got to get the app. Get the app, Power Talk 1210. Just search for it. You can get it for iPhone, Android, whichever one you want to get. Whichever one you're using, you can get that app. Download it. Listen to us live. If you miss it, we've always got the shows on the website, SolomonOnBlast.com. They're out there from the past few weeks, so you can get a chance to listen to them when you have time. In the book of Proverbs, Solomon is writing to his son, obviously, in order to provide his son with the best advice possible for his life, which is what any true father wants to do for his son. And Solomon lays out a significant amount of wisdom he's acquired throughout his life, most of it written in nice, short, easily remembered passages, and some parables, which make it at many times a lot easier to remember than the actual issue being addressed when you have it in a parable. The problem we have as fathers, though, is how do you ensure the wisdom gets used? We talk a lot about the increasing problem of young men growing up without fathers and the issues that come about because of it, and the anger and rebellion and how it can affect their whole lives. And that is a real problem. But what about those children, those boys and young men that are raised in a normal two-parent household when they have the advantages of a stable home? You know, why do they have a tendency to follow a path that leads to disappointment? There was an article about 3 years ago that came out, hit the internet, went viral, and it was based on a story of a gentleman out of the UK who had written a letter to his children. And he was a retired naval officer. His name's Nick Cruz, so if you want to go read this, I'm going to read it, but if you want to look it up. He wrote a letter to his children indicating how disappointed he was in what they had done in their lives. So I'm going to read this, and this is all from his letter, and kind of get an idea of some of the disappointment that can occur when kids behave the way they do. He has three children, so he starts it off, "Dear all three, with last evening's crop of whinings and tidings of more rotten news of which you seem to treat your mother like a cesspit." Okay, now remember this guy, interject here, that this guy's from the UK, so there's a little bit of different nomenclature than we would expect here in the United States. Anyways, he says, I feel it's time to come off my perch. It's obvious that none of you has the faintest notion of the bitter disappointment each of you has in your own way dished out to us. We are seeing the miserable death throes of the fourth of your collective marriages at a time we see the advent of a fifth. We're constantly regaled with chapter and verse of the happy, successful lives of the families of our friends and relatives and being asked of news of our own children and grandchildren. I wonder if you realize how we feel. We have nothing to say which reflects any credit on you or us. We don't ask for your sympathy or understanding. Mom and I have been used to taking our own misfortunes on the chin and making our own effort to bash our little paths through life without being a burden to others. Having done our best, probably misguidedly, to provide for our children, we naturally hope to see them in turn take up their own banners and provide happy and stable home for their children. Fulfilling careers based on your education would have helped, but as yet, none of you is what I would confidently term properly self-supporting. Now, just interject here, these kids' ages range between 35 and 40 years old, so he's not talking to 20-somethings. Which of you, with or without a spouse, can support your families, finance your home, and provide a pension for your old age? Each of you is well able to earn a comfortable living and provide for your children, yet each of you has contrived to avoid even moderate achievement. Far from your children being able to rely on your provision, they're faced with needing to survive their introduction to life with you as parents. So we witness the introduction of this life of six beautiful children, soon to be seven, none of whose parents have had the maturity and sound judgment to make a reasonable fist at making essential threshold decisions. None of these decisions were made with any pretense to ask for our advice. In each case, we've been expected to acquiesce with mostly hasty, but always, in our view, badly judged decisions. None of you have done yourself or given to us the basic courtesy to ask us what we think while there was still time finally to think things through. The predictable result has been a decade of deep unhappiness over the fate of our grandchildren. If it wasn't for them, Mom and I would not be too concerned, as each of you consciously and with eyes wide open crashes from one cock up to the next. It makes us weak that so many of these events are copulation driven, and then helplessly to see these lovely little people being so woefully let down by you, their parents. I can now tell you that I, for one, and I sense Mom feels the same, have had enough of being forced to live through the never-ending bad dream of our children's underachievement and domestic ineptitudes. I want to hear no more from any of you until, if you feel inclined, you have a success or an achievement or a realistic plan for support and happiness of your children to tell me about. I don't want to see your mother burdened with any more of your miserable woes. It's not as if any of the advice she strives to give you has ever been listened to with good grace, far less acted upon. So I ask you to spare her further unhappiness. If you think I've been unfair in what I've said, by all means, try to persuade me to change my mind. But you won't do it by simply whining and saying you don't like it. You'll have to come up with meaty reasons to demolish my points and build a case for yourself. If that is impossible or you simply can't be bothered, then I rest my case. And he ends it with, I am bitterly, bitterly disappointed. Now, I think if you look at it from the view of what Solomon has given us, I think this guy, maybe he was reading this. Proverbs 10:1 says, a wise son brings joy to his father, but a foolish son brings grief to his mother. And in this case, maybe more than just the son. So why is it that so many young people end up, I would say, maybe as rebels without a cause, rebelling against the wisdom that they're given without any real basis behind it? So that's kind of the question we'll be doing after we come back from this break. So we'll be back with a little more of Solomon on Blast.
Does it seem like your car is driving you around in circles? It probably is if you've been driving Tucson city streets and your car is out of alignment. If it is, then it's costing you money. Your tires wear out faster and you're spending more on gas. So what should you do? If you're wise, you call Mike Vance at Alignment Brake and Suspension, 722-2276. Mike's been in business in Tucson for over 25 years and has the experience to diagnose and fix that alignment problem right the first time. As the name says, though, he doesn't just do alignments. If you've got brake or suspension problems, or for that matter, just about any car problem, Mike has the expertise to fix it. As a longtime customer of Mike's, I assure you, he'll treat you with integrity and get you back on the road without running you around in circles. So give Mike a call at Alignment Brake and Suspension, 722-2276, and tell him Doug from Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210 sent you. It's the wisest thing you can do for all your car repair needs. Alignment Brake and Suspension, 722-2276.
I could just explain. You see, we just moved here, you understand, and the kid hasn't got any friends, you understand?
Hey, well,
and
we moved into it.
Will you hold it, Jim?
Tell him, man, why we moved here.
Will you hold it?
You can't protect me.
Do you mind if I try? Do you have to slam the door in my face?
I try to get to him. What happens? Huh?
Don't I buy you everything you want? A bicycle? You get a bicycle. A car?
You buy me many things.
No. Well, not just buy. We give you love and affection, don't we? Well, then what is it? Was it because we went to that party? Well, you know what kind of drunken brawls those kind of parties turn into. It's not a place for kids.
A minute ago, you said you didn't care if he drinks.
He said a little drink.
You're tearing me apart!
Yeah, you're tearing me apart, according to James Dean. If you don't know, that's from the movie Rebels Without a Cause, and that was filmed in 1955. That was one of the last films that James Dean had done, and it really made a groundbreaking attempt to kind of portray the moral decay of American youth in a time frame when most kids were growing up in a two-family household. And I think the film is trying to portray these people looking for that father figure that they didn't have in their own families. But the father in that scene was pretty disappointed with his son's behavior. He's been called out of one of their parties to go get his son out of jail after he got pulled over, or I guess arrested for drunkenness. But that really is one of the big issues, I think, in a father's life is just having that disappointment in what your children end up doing. Obviously, that letter from the guy there in London, from the ex-British military guy, he obviously had a good background and everything else. I'm sure his kids were raised well, and they went to private school, according to the articles. But, boy, he was pretty disappointed by him in that particular situation. So how do you really deal with this, as Solomon says, a foolish son that brings grief to his mother and probably disappointment to his father?
You know, it's really going to be one of the great mysteries of life, Doug, because everybody at the end of the day is their own person as well. And so I think the real challenge in all of that is imparting something in life that will do your kids good when they get to a certain age. And, you know, this is how it rolls. This is the way generation moves to one generation. There's an interesting verse from Solomon where Ernest Hemingway got the title of one of his books. It's called The Sun Also Rises. Mm-hmm. And basically he's just saying one generation gives way to the next. And, you know, things come, things go, and the sun is going to come back.
You know,
The Sun Also Rises actually comes right out of that statement that it's basically the sun's going to go up, it's going to go down, and generations will come and generations will go. And really, you get into the heart of soul, really, beyond even Christianity. This is probably more prominent in Judaism, that side of the Bible religion, and that is how to impact one generation to the next, how to impart, you know, how to train them, how to get them to see the world a certain way, and then having to believe by faith somehow this is going to continue and go forward, you know.
Yeah,
and survive all the different challenges that are going to come at it.
If you look at that movie Rebel Without a Cause, that was one of their things that they were really exploring in that movie, was the differences and the conflicts between the generations. And that was at a time when, you know, things were a lot less confrontational, we would think, to the point where the film was even banned in New Zealand out of the fear that it would incite teenage delinquency. And so they ended up actually releasing it the following year, but they cut out certain scenes to try and minimize the impact to it. And in Britain, that film was released with an X rating with scenes cut out of it. So it had a pretty wide-reaching...
Probably just the title itself, you know.
Yeah, Rebels Without a Cause. But the point of the without a cause part is, in a time frame when stable families existed and you grew up with both parents, really what is the cause for the rebellion? And that's part of the
question. That was the idea in the post-World War II, you know, prosperity of the United States. There were lots of people living in other parts of the world that were involved in all kinds of rebellious causes, but they all had some kind of political impetus to them, you know?
Right.
They were, you know, communists, or they were fighting with fascists, or they were doing something that, you know, at least gave their cause some kind of definition, whereas in the, you know, America, all of a sudden appliances and people have expendable income and they've got time to waste, and teenagers are going to, you know, dances and stuff like that, Bobby Sox dances. You know, they couldn't figure out. You'd think they thought, oh, finally, these people with all this, you know, opportunity and prosperity should really be having fun, having a good time. Well, I think what it speaks to is just the human struggle. It doesn't matter where you are. You're going to have to work your way through some personal challenges.
Right, because the movie was really set more in the idea of the suburban middle-class families, where I think prior to that, a lot of the juvenile delinquents from the movie perspective, were those kids that were living in the urban environment, and that was more of the,
you know, West Side Story.
Exactly,
right?
That was my point. The one I was thinking of was West Side Story. It's the urban gang members, juvenile delinquents, where here you're looking at middle America, just like we see today.
And that also, that book that was later made into a movie by S.E. Hinton, The Outsiders. You know, she was actually a young girl when she wrote that. That's the amazing thing. And they used her initials because they didn't want people would never buy a book from a little girl named Susie, I guess. She describes the same thing, you know, what does she call them? The greasers and the socks, you know, the socialites. And, you know, society's always had those elements to them, to it, obviously. Right. But what they're trying to wrap their minds around is, how could people from prosperity be so restless?
Right.
You know, and, you know, well, the thing is, again, it's just about, it's a common human trait. Every generation has to figure itself out, just like the previous generation. And I think there's a lot of false assumptions that always happen, especially when parents assume they've done their best, and they think that automatically when you do your best, that means it's going to compute out a certain way. And how can it? I mean, I always ask that question.
That's our hope,
I was,
right?
A piece of work when I was a teenager, you know?
But, you know, did you feel that you were a disappointment to your father at that point in time, though, when you were?
I probably didn't think too deeply about that, and I'm kind of glad I didn't, because I might have drawn that conclusion. But, you know, who knows? I know they gave us some good opportunities.
And, I mean, we've all, some of us anyways, have done things that we weren't, you know, didn't want our parents to find out about.
And most people.
Right.
And that, I mean, like 99.99% of humanity.
Right. Which meant.
And the other 1% probably has a reason.
We were trying not to disappoint them from whatever method. Maybe not always from the right approach, but, you know, and I think there can be a lot of disappointment in our lives when we have the high expectations and for our children, our sons, and they fall short of it, right? When they're born, we have a concept of, you know, upward mobility, I guess, is what I would kind of say.
Right.
We want our children to have a better life than what we came through. And you see that with a lot of these people that they didn't graduate from high school, and hey, as long as my kid can get out of high school with a, you know, and do something in his life, he's improved over what I did, or the one that I only made it through high school. You know, I want my kid to go to college and be a college graduate, the first in the family to graduate from college, kind of thing. So there's that hope that there's an upward mobility, upward progress. And when that doesn't happen and things end up the opposite direction, I think you can find that there's a lot of disappointment, that you start looking at yourself, wondering, you know, what did I do wrong? Is, you know, the fear that I failed somehow, and could I have done something differently?
Well, I think we could always do something differently. And, you know, in hindsight, of course, you know, the whole cliche about hindsight. But if I were to do it over again, you know, I would say, my kids, they're adults now. I would say you put a lot more in up front. And I think even if when I look at Deuteronomy 6, you know, I didn't quite understand what all that meant at the time. But basically, the Bible teaches, and according to the, you know, the Judaic concepts, was you inculcate your small children. You ask them questions later in life. Mm-hmm. And you know, to kind of show you the balance of this, the Jewish culture is known for asking great questions. So, but they don't teach their kids to ask questions, according to the Deuteronomy. You inculcate them. You tell them what life is about when they're very young. And when they get older, then they begin to use the powers of you know, of critiquing and, mm-hmm. and criticism and whatnot. And it seems like you load them up early, and that quality develops later in life. But it's opposite today. You know, they're using the question method to kids very young. Johnny, would you like to, you know, red? Would you like blue?
Instead of, do you want a hamburger?
Yeah.
Do you want a
and hot so, you know,
here's
you have
for
a,
dinner.
a 4-year-old kid, you know, just ruling the roost because their parents are waiting for a good answer, thinking that's developing this skill in them, when in reality, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think they're setting that kid up to be a follower. And not, and because you don't have, you're not
at that age,
at that age
to have the ability to reason and make a choice, right?
No, and I think this is getting back to Rebel Without a Cause. You're talking about a restlessness just in the human spirit. And I think the key is just trying to get as much good information in that kid as you possibly can early in life. And then later in life, they will be equipped then to ask some good questions. And hopefully make some good decisions with those questions.
So that's Solomon's statement that you're supposed to train up a child in the way he should go. And when he's older, he
won't depart. Most 4-year-olds just can't really buy into the Socratic method. I just don't think they're going to get it and understand it. I think you actually frustrate kids by not giving them enough direction when they're very young.
Because they don't have that ability to reason.
They're not
at
capable
that level.
Yeah, exactly.
And if they do, they're going to go with their basic instincts of, well, I like the taste of ice cream, so yeah, I'm going to have ice cream every day.
M&M's and ice cream all day long, you know, if you let them choose. And every parent knows that.
Right.
And you know that instinctively as well, but I think people are confused about that, and I think there's a lot of wisdom in the approach of just teaching your kids when they're very young. So here's the thing that we run into all the time is, I don't really teach my kids religion, and when they're old, they're going to be able to decide what they want to do. It's exactly the opposite. You want to teach your child a serious-minded worldview when they're very small. When they are old, they will be equipped to ask good questions. Don't worry. They will be able to say, I don't want to do this anymore, or I'd rather do it like that, or I'd rather, you know what I mean, I'd rather approach God this way or that way.
Right.
They think that they're somehow helping them find their way later by not
giving them anything.
By not, and it's the opposite. The most serious thoughts these kids grow up with come from Oprah and Dr. Phil, and that's a tragedy because they should have to wrap their minds around good and evil, right and wrong. Is there a God? Is there a real physical devil like Antonin Scalia talked about in one of the articles? And he brought that up, and the interviewer said, I can't believe that you actually believe in an actual devil. And his response to this interviewer was, smarter people than you or I have believed in an actual devil. And he begins to list some of these great intellects throughout history that have, in their writings, had suggested as much. But What it is that you got this whole generation that's never been confronted with these kind of thoughts. They've never had to think through them.
Right.
And
tell them there's evil out there.
Yeah,
it's
always this softball. And
don't talk to strangers. That's about the extent.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Stranger danger is the extent of
evil. And global warming and environmentalism and all that.
Those kind of things.
But to have to confront mortality and good and evil and right and wrong and think about those thoughts as a small child. And talking about equipping that child with a mechanism later in life. And, you know, if you ever read some of the great authors,
Well, hold that thought because we're coming up on the half hour, so we're going to take a break. We'll come back with more of this discussion here on Solomon on Blast. All right, we're back with more of Solomon on Blast. So one of the things I was thinking about, you know, when we read that statement from Solomon that a wise son brings joy and a foolish one is grief to his mother, I'm thinking, here's the wisest man that lived, according to the Bible, and he had given all of this wisdom to his son, and it turns out his son doesn't pay any attention to it because he rebels against his father and actually divides the kingdom of Israel. So was he a disappointment to his father? Probably so, if he had still been alive. But, you know, as flawed as we are, here you have the wisest man alive, and it didn't even work for him.
Right.
So it's kind of an interesting aspect of it that, well, maybe all that regret and the feeling condemned by what we perceive to be our failure with our limitations, maybe it's not so unreasonable and easier to see it when you look at it from the fact that here's Solomon and it didn't work for him.
Well, all you can do, really, is you lay a foundation. And again, going back, I would say, if I could give any parent the advice, is major on foundation. Just major on foundation. In fact, Solomon brought that up. And what's it? Chapter 22. I mean, I know we're not doing chapter and verses, but he said, train a child in the way they should go, and when they're old, they will not depart from it. Now, I think more literally in English kind of makes that sound a certain way, but I think the word there is dedicate a child to a path. Is that probably a better way to translate that?
Okay.
You dedicate your child to a path.
That gives you a good visual aspect of what you're trying to do.
Right, and it also shows just how much work you got to put in early on. And I think as young parents that you're busy, you're got to work, you got to do, and sometimes the kids are all along for the ride,
mm-hmm.
and because they're all along for a ride, TV makes a good babysitter, videos, you know, the kids today, man, they have to watch the same Disney film, you know, just
400 times,
traveling just like 5 blocks to the grocery store, but they got to turn it on. Mm-hmm. That can't be good, Doug. I don't know, you know, I don't have any studies or anything like that, but that cannot be good.
Yeah, you know? I think back to my childhood and I think, well, did you really ever have anything that you wanted to watch that many times over and over? Yeah, every year, usually they came out with The Wizard of Oz, so you'd always watch that, but that was like a once a year thing. It wasn't 5 times in the 15-minute drive to the...
It's mind-numbing, you know?
Right.
Just blinking lights. And I tell you, some sinister plot could be to put subliminal messages in Disney cartoons. You know, these kids are going to get them.
You mean they're not already there?
They're hooking me up to a catheter and letting me watch all 10 hours of Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, exactly. You will need a catheter. That's the truth.
That's healthy.
No.
So but definitely.
Yeah, and
you know, that's just the what I'm just saying. This kind of it's so easy when kids are small to drag them along for the ride, but I would say that is the time, really, where the Old Testament teaches you to get them, mm-hmm. them very early, to inculcate them with a worldview. And when they are old, then they're going to people will choose. And see, going back to that verse, it actually says, dedicate them to a path that leads to the mouth. And this is a very interesting word because that's the literal translation of that verse. And so the idea is like the mouth of a cave, you know, like the mouth of a, it's like a threshold would be
okay.
A better way to say it. You lead them to a threshold, and on that threshold,
then they have the choices.
Hey, God has given them the same inalienable rights as their parents.
Right.
They're going to go forth.
And when you consider the fact that nobody in their right mind would just tell their kid, okay, you can go to the store whenever you want, right, and walk whichever way you want to walk. As a young child, they'd make sure, and I see it more so now than when I was a kid, we walked to school pretty much on our own. Nowadays, I see parents standing at the bus stop until the bus shows up, or they drive their kids to school. There's no way they would ever allow that child to venture out on their own from a physical aspect, but from a mental aspect, they're doing that entirely. They're allowing them to venture out and go try and figure out how to get from point A to point B as a young child when they don't have the ability to make those decisions, like we said.
No, they don't. And they need lots of really strong moral teaching early to just be equipped with the right tools to later on work through all those ideas. Mm-hmm. And they will work through them. That's the thing. The idea that they're going to be somehow in bondage to this. And so I wanted to get back to the authors. I was talking about some of the best authors, American authors of the 20th century, had very strong religious backgrounds. And a lot of them are to be very honest, didn't complain about their religious upbringings. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, their religious upbringings still provided them with the tools to excel and to become whoever they wanted to become.
A foundation for them.
For example, I was thinking about Jack Kerouac. You know, Jack Kerouac is the author of On the Road, which is, you know, the hippie, the tome the hippies all bowed down to.
The beatniks
and all that. Kerouac, that's actually a fantastically written book, in my opinion. And he was always a little bit sore about the idea that people just saw it as a phenomenon and not a well-written novel.
Mm-hmm.
And, didn't get enough credit as an author, which I agree. I don't think he got enough credit just as an author. But, you know, here's a guy writing about hitchhiking across the country, just throwing caution to the wind, just, you know, getting out there and exploring new experiences and experimenting with all this different stuff. But, you know, he said all of his life he considered himself to be a Catholic, and which was kind of interesting to me because you would think that he would have just cast that off.
He was rebelling against it, right?
Yeah. But no, he had a worldview that was given to him when he was very young. He was well-trained to whatever degree, and he was what he was. And you think about like somebody like my brother was really an avid reader, and I learned from him a lot of these Portnoy's Complaint. I can't remember the author's name right offhand, but you know, this guy had a very strict conservative Jewish upbringing, he talks about it, and he's even the whole idea is he's laying on a psychiatrist's couch and he's going through, you know, all of his neurosis and hang-ups from it. But the truth is it provided an information source for him, you know, about the world. And so here's this guy's a fantastic author. His name will come to me, Philip. His name will come to me in a second. But the point is these guys had something behind them. You know, they weren't just raised in a vacuum.
Right.
You know, they weren't feral children. You know what I mean? They right. came up with a worldview. And
wasn't
that worldview was
Lord
a basis.
Of the Flies approach
exactly,
to world.
And how they approached the world to come. And so this is what we're looking at today. Now, this is the conflict that we're talking about. Because kids are going to make their own decisions, does that mean that you just kind of let them find their own way early? I say absolutely not. You load them up early, and they're going to make their own decisions.
Well, I think if you look at it from the aspect of what the radical Muslims are doing, isn't that what they are doing? They're loading them up very early with a worldview.
They're loading them up with more than just views.
It is more than a view, but these guys are
difference, though.
It's not the correct view, obviously.
No, I'm just talking about the difference. They also, they don't just load them up early. They actually control them within their culture and society, so which is a different idea. I'm saying you load kids up early, and you believe that their freedom is going to lead them to the right thing. Right.
There is no free will.
In the proper direction. Mm-hmm. They don't exercise free will. They condemn the person that exercises free will. And so, yes.
But as in that younger, time frame when they're more open to the input, like you said, that's what they are doing. They are inculcating them in their view. But they just don't let the freedom part of it, when they do get old enough to make choices, they don't let them take those freedoms. So part of the other part of this is that there is the wise son side of it that brings joy to his father, according to Solomon. And we do see that. It's the wise son is the one that actually learns from other people's mistakes, rather than making them on his own, which is typically a lot more costly. And so there are those positive sides to what Solomon's talking about. You know, it's not all just the disappointment. And I think about just what was going on this past week at the Republican debate. You look at who was up on that stage, and there's a wide range of sons that obviously I would expect aren't a disappointment to their fathers, but they came from different backgrounds, pretty much the two-parent family. And there is a joy, I'm sure, for them, for their fathers, in seeing what they've been able to accomplish, whether it's Donald Trump.
I think there's a great joy hearing a Donald Trump insult their children on national television. You know, I agree. I agree to a certain extent, because, you know, if you want to define success that way, you know, we don't know what's behind the world of the politician.
And it's not always that being the success. You know, it's not always the upward mobility, the fact that they're, you know, made it to the point where they're running for president, that kind of thing. But there is, if you really look at it, there's sons of a famous person. Obviously, Trump's father was fairly well off and everything, but there's also the sons of the not so famous.
I'm hearing numbers, getting back to Trump, about how much money he inherited. Maybe his father, but I read The Art of the Deal years ago, and he certainly didn't describe a $200 million inheritance in The Art of the Deal, which is a number that Rubio threw out, I guess.
Yeah, that's what he threw out on Tuesday.
So I don't know. That confuses me a little bit.
But he had a good basis for where he came from.
His father
from, right?
was a prosperous.
Right. Whereas both Cruz and Rubio, they're not coming in from parents that were very, very prosperous. They mm-hmm. worked their way up to where they're at. But they did it with a good foundation to build on and had those choices, obviously letting, in some cases, learning from other people's situations so that they're not repeating those same kind of thing. Now, there was a comment from Warren Buffett at his recent annual meeting, and he basically says that these politicians are being way too negative about the future that our children have in place for them. Actually, the one statement he says, today's politicians need not shed tears for tomorrow's children. So I think what he's looking at is the fact that, you know, we do have a pretty good basis, foundation within this country to let the growth that we've had in the past and the prosperity, the economic situation, it's not always going to be bad, and that there's still those same opportunities exist, and that the politicians shouldn't be bashing our situation.
Well, the human spirit is resilient, and this is the this is something that both vexes a parent, but it should also encourage a parent, and that is that our children are more than the sum total either of our successes or our mistakes. They're their own people, just like we are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in one sense you can say there are going to be some creative and able people that are going to come along, just like they do in every generation, and make a difference, you know. And that we don't have to fret about that. But here's where I would question that. I believe that the United States of America as a country absolutely needs the Constitution to be intact, to prosper. And I think when the United States Constitution is dismissed or corrupted or completely violated or just made into a joke, then I do not think that this country is going to survive that well. I think it's going to lead to massive social unrest, which is going to lead to all kinds of other, you know, other issues. And we're talking that I don't care how good the economy is doing. The economy cannot survive civil war.
Right.
You know, so to say that America can just continue in any form we want it to be, I think is delusional. The Constitution is built into itself, you know. Mm. The idea that it must be maintained or it can only be changed a certain way. And if the Constitution is undermined and, like I said, just completely dismissed in whatever way and violated constantly, it's going to cause problems in this country. It's meant to cause problems in this country. It's written into it mm-hmm. to cause those problems. And so I don't think they can just say, oh, it doesn't matter. We'll just kind of reinvent ourselves along the way. I don't think it's that simple.
No. All right, we'll come back with the final segment of Solomon on Blast after these commercial breaks. We'll be back. All right, we're back with more of Solomon on Blast, last segment here this morning. So how do you overcome that disappointment? I think in some respects it does have to do with our level of expectations, and that determines the level of our disappointment. It's not that we want to have no expectations for our children, but we can't rely on our expectations of them, you know, becoming the next president of the United States, or, you know, my son's going to be the next basketball superstar, as to drive what we're really looking for in how our kids turn out. And, you know, you made the comment over as we were coming into this that the Constitution is really the key part of being able to have these continued economic growth. And I think not having that within the education system, because obviously they don't want to teach that within the school system. It is more about the about the global environment and the global climate and all that kind of stuff, you know, recycling, that they want to teach the kids. When you lose that within the education system, you're going to end up with kids that believe, okay, everything needs to be given to me because the government's the one that's running things. We really need to look at our expectations of what our kids are, have higher expectations that aren't, I guess, maybe as economically based, which we tend to do. You know, Solomon does kind of say that be happy with your lot in life, you know, be satisfied with what you're able to live with. And in Ecclesiastes, he's a little more cynical about it, but he does boil it down to the basics. So in order to really overcome that disappointment, I think you have to look back at what your expectations are. And, you know, not everybody's kid's going to go to college. Not everybody's kid's going to be the next Michael Jordan.
Well, you know, we're talking about him and his son. But listen, like, at the end of Ecclesiastes, which is really the flip side to the book of Proverbs. Mm-hmm. For those people that read the Bible, both sides are filled with incredible wisdom and insight. But Proverbs is part one. It's his young. Everything makes sense. Everything, two and two is four. It's all perfect in his mind how the life works. And then he grows up and life doesn't work out exactly like he thought it would.
This is kind of him looking, yeah, King Solomon looking forward and telling his son, inculcating him with his wisdom as a young man.
Yeah, a young person's wisdom. And then Ecclesiastes is an old man's wisdom, right, which is a whole lot more cynical. But he does come bring it down to the statement, remember, he's talking to the young. He says, remember your creator in the days of your youth before the days of trouble come. And then he goes through this whole thing, and he says, now everything's been heard. Here's the conclusion of the matter: fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the duty of mankind. So, in other words, he wasn't asking his son to be a superhero.
Right.
He was just saying, when it all said and done, be a decent person. Be real. Don't be a fraud. You know. Don't be a thief. Don't, you know. Take care of your kids. Be the man you should be. And I think that's his conclusion, that you don't have to be all that.
Right. And I think that's kind of what that guy was talking about in the letter that he sent out to his kids. You know, just at least be decent towards your own kids. I think that was, if you read that letter, I think he was kind of irritated by the fact that his children were getting married, getting divorced, having kids, but they weren't really supporting their own children, that they were dumping their problems and everything else in their parents' lap and not addressing those things. So just the very basics of, hey, be mature, take care of your kids, and not be a burden upon your mother because they were all the grief that they were providing dishing out there.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of the expectation thing, I believe, is really something that comes from our an overimportance we put on pop culture.
Right.
Because we're always told what what's exciting, what's wonderful, what's meaningful, you know, the beautiful people and all the stuff that are constantly, these ideas that are constantly being fed to us. And so we start equating, maybe the, I should put it this way, the, one of our problems is we equate what we want our kids to be with the wrong definitions of success, you know?
Right. What it, when you really define what is success, then you can address this problem of expectations. If our belief is success is purely financial and only when, you know, they're in college making, you know, twice what I made when I started and that kind of thing, if that isn't our definition of success, but success is raising your own children, giving them good moral values, developing good relationships.
Yeah, working through your your problems, showing them stability, showing them you can live life, you can win. You know, let's face it, parents are bipolar on this. On one hand, well, I should just say Americans in general, on one hand, we want them to be people, be prosperous.
Right.
We want them to have position,
that's the American
and power
dream, right?
And all this other stuff. But on the other hand, you know, except for the people voting for him, everybody hates Donald Trump.
Right. What
is he? He's a rich guy, position, power, running right. President. You know, so yeah, it goes both ways, you know. I think the point is, I think Solomon, I love his writings, and I think we both do this. I think that's why we call this Solomon on Blast, is because he kind of covers all these bases. He goes on an emotional, spiritual, and intellectual journey through right. truth. And he arrives at all these incredible conclusions, I think, that are extremely helpful to anybody in any time, in any place,
and,
in any generation.
And I was thinking about it from the aspect of, is Solomon's wisdom from his observation of the people and the world around him, or was it maybe more from his own personal experience? So when you start reading through Proverbs, it's Proverbs and all these great tidbits of wisdom that he's given his son, is it more from the mistakes that he made and the possibility that he saw the consequences of them and said, okay, here's the wisdom I want to give you?
I think Solomon wrote a lot of that, or compiled it too. You know, I don't think every single statement there was invented by him either.
No, I don't think so either.
I think a lot of it was compiled wisdom as well.
Right, but was it some of it based on personal experience?
I think he was a younger man. It definitely, to me, sounds like coming. I don't think he's looking back. I think he's informing him about, hey, this is life, and this is how the game of life is supposed to be played. And nothing, it's not wrong, but it just, once he himself lives a bunch of life, he realizes that it didn't exactly work maybe like he thought it would.
Right.
And let's face it, our kids have to have the same leeway to experience, to come to those same conclusions, right?
Right. And
what works and what doesn't.
Right. And I think in the end, we want to treat our children fairly, but not always maybe as equals, but we want to treat them fairly and give them that opportunity to go out there and make the decisions on their own. As we always like to say when we end, there's always one greater than Solomon, and that is Christ. And from John 3:35, he says, "The Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand." And that is what we're really basing our hopes on, is that the perfect Son and the perfect Father is the view.